On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about how it's been hard to track COVID-19 infections, but it looks like Apple and Google might have a bold and ambitious plan to help. That's right. Also, would you be surprised if I told you that a new study is saying that one or more devices accessing your corporate network from a home network might already be infected with malware? Think about that. We'll talk about that as well. Plus, Brian, Heather, and I talk with a great guest, Chris Wynn, CEO of LogDNA, to talk about modernizing log management. Don't want to miss it. It's Wyatt on the set. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Stay in control when it comes to your company's access points and authentication. LastPass makes enterprise-level security simple for your remote workforce. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 389, recorded April 17th, 2020. Log data mining with LogDNA. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. From access to authentication to passwords, LastPass manages every point to your business so you can mitigate risk while improving employee productivity. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise, but I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field, starting with our very own Heather Williams, Manager for Solution Engineering over there at Records Networks. Mo, it's great to have you back on. How are things with you?
Things are going just great. I unlike all of you, I suspect I'm the only one who's not at home. I am actually about 100 yards from home in a homework pavilion garage that I have set up that has a Wi-Fi hotspot for the neighborhood kids.
Wow. Well, we haven't talked a while. Obviously, with all the things going on around the globe, how has your normal work week changed? What's been going on for you?
So I haven't been in an office since 2004. And so the one thing that has really changed is that I've been coaching the guys on my team that are new to work from home. I've eschewed video conference calls just because I don't think anyone needs to see my smiling face at every call. But I've now mandated at least once a week, everybody has to turn their camera on so that there's, you know, I make sure that there, people are showered.
Good, yeah.
You know, there's no conspiracy boards in the background.
Very good. Just keeping
an eye on people.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have you back on. Well, this next co-host is also no stranger to change. Mr. Brian Henry, Director of Global Solutions Architect over at F5 Networks. BAM, great to have you back on. How are things over there on the East Coast?
Oh, it's a little chillier than I'd like. But other than that, you know, staying safe, staying healthy, and, you know, managing to check on my two teenage kids every once in a while, and they seem to be getting work done. So that's a good thing.
Fantastic. Well, speaking about getting work done, we have a lot of work here this week since we have a lot of enterprise news. So let's go ahead and get started. Now, it's been hard to track COVID-19, but it looks like Apple and Google might have a bold and ambitious plan to help. We'll see if that's a good plan or not. Also, would you be surprised if I told you that in the current climate, nearly one in two organizations has one or more devices accessing its corporate network from home network with at least one malware infection there? Well, we'll have to get into that discussion and see how true that is. Plus, we have to have a great guest, Chris Wynn, CEO of LogDNA, to talk about modernizing log management. But first, we have a lot of enterprise news this week. So let's go ahead and start the show and jump into this week's blips. Now, many organizations are looking for cloud-based code and project repositories. Some use them for code, deployment bits, content, and many other facets of their business because of the change tracking capabilities, merging, and commit models there. Now, GitHub is one of these staples in the world of cloud-native development, and it's most known for open source public projects. However, for years, many teams have used GitHub for private projects or stealth ones that could eventually be made public. However, if it wasn't public, it would require a team and a role management to actually pay as well. It wasn't free until now. That's right. This week, GitHub has announced that they will be making all private repositories with unlimited collaborators available to all GitHub accounts. All of the core GitHub features are now free for everyone. Now, this means teams can now manage their work together in one place, CI/CD loops, project management, code review, packages, and more. And it also means they're also reducing the price for a paid team plan from $9 per user month to $4 per user month, effective immediately. Now, existing customers will have their bills automatically reduced going forward. Now, the paid tiers do offer some additional stuff. It adds features like required reviewers, code owners, SAML sign-on, and advanced auditing capabilities. Now, this move puts GitHub in a more competitive space to companies like Atlassian, Bitbucket, and GitLab. It also opens the door to usage of a platform that many are already familiar with and can provide the facilities a team needs to collaborate. Now, this is especially important in today's climate of the remote workforce. Now, if you were reluctant to start a project due to the cost, it might be time for you to commit to GitHub.
According to one lab director, hospitals are astonishingly unprepared to deal with academic labs. Testing is one of the most important tools for getting the coronavirus pandemic under control in the United States. More than 160,000 COVID-19 tests were performed in the U.S. on Thursday, according to the COVID-19 Tracking Project. But there's good reason to believe that there are still many people with the virus who have not been tested. More testing would help guide treatment and quarantine decisions and give government officials more data about the extent of the COVID-19 outbreak. At the same time, a Nature investigation has revealed that a number of academic labs capable of performing COVID-19 tests are operating well below capacity. Nature's reporting suggests that incompatible IT systems are significant reasons for this mismatch. Many hospitals are used to working with the large commercial labs that have the software necessary to interface with a hospital's electronic health records and billing systems. When an academic lab shows up with the capacity to run tests, but not the infrastructure to interface with hospital systems, hospitals are unfortunately reluctant to do business with them.
Sales of online fraud guides are booming. A ZDNet article published today describes work done by cybersecurity researchers at Terbium Labs, who look at offerings on three major dark web exchanges, half of which are cookbooks and how-to guides for wannabe online criminals looking for that first big break. These include descriptions of how to develop a phishing campaign and business email scams, many targeted at the financial sector. In an ironic twist that proves there really is no honor among thieves, it turns out that many of these guides are fakes and contain no useful information for the aspiring cyber criminal. The good news is that stolen personal data only makes up about 15% of the listings. The bad news is that the cost for your data continues to be as low as $1 for a single personal record. Financial data, including payment card information and compromised PayPal accounts that can be exploited to make purchases, set up loans, or outright steal money, are more lucrative, of course. So how can organizations protect themselves? Be aware of data breaches and incidents where credentials have been leaked. Encourage employees to never reuse passwords and set up multi-factor authentication on business accounts. Remember, it's not about making yourself hack-proof. It's about making your accounts more trouble than it's worth.
Now, with the increased work from home, you might be thinking, well, I need to get some more storage, maybe get a new NAS or even upgrade my NAS. Well, it seems you might want to be vigilant here, because if you buy drives for a NAS or a new NAS unit, you might not be getting the storage you've been looking for. Now, storage vendors, including but reportedly not limited to Western Digital, have quietly begun shipping SMR, which is shingled magnetic recording discs, in place of the earlier conventional magnetic recording, or CMR, discs. Now, SMR is a technology that allows vendors to squeeze out higher storage densities, netting more terabyte capacity on the same number of platters, or even fewer platters, for the same amount of terabytes or storage. Now, the devil's in the details here. It sounds all great, but until recently, the technology has only been seen in very large disks, which were typically cleared and clearly marked as archival. Now, additional to the higher capacities, SMR is associated with much lower random I/O performance than CMR disks offer. Surprise! Now, storage vendors appear to be getting much bolder about deploying the new technology in the even smaller formats, presumably to save a bit of manufacturing costs. Go figure. Now, some NAS units have issues with SMRs. They don't know how to handle some of the data interactions. In fact, there has been speculation that the drives got kicked out of their arrays due to long timeouts. Now, SMR disks need to perform garbage collection routines in the background and store incoming writes in a small CMR encoded write cache area of the disks before moving them to the main SMR encoded storage. Now, it's possible that the long periods of time that would with new writes accepted triggered failure detection routines that marked the disks bad. So some of these NAS units can't handle this. Now, what does this mean for buyers out there? Well, just be vigilant. Ensure that you know the models of the drives you're getting before you hit that buy button.
Citing the misrouting of U.S. internet traffic, malicious hacking, and control by the Chinese government, a group of U.S. executive agencies is recommending the FCC revoke the license authorizing China Telecom to provide international telecommunications services to and from the United States. The recommendations comes amid an escalation in tensions between the U.S. and China over a host of issues, including trade, disagreements about the handling of the novel coronavirus, and hacking. Thursday's move comes as part of a review the FCC disclosed last year when the agency barred China Mobile Limited from the U.S. market. The federal government has also designated both Huawei and ZTE as national security threats. Over the past decade, the Chinese telecom has been at the center of several major security events, most visibly those involving misrouting of huge chunks of internet traffic sent to and from the U.S. and other countries. One of the more concerning events came to light in 2018 when a researcher revealed that China Telecom had diverted U.S. domestic internet communications to mainland China before sending them on to their intended destinations. The improper paths, which were results of manipulations to Border Gateway Protocol or BGP tables that route traffic from one backbone provider to another, occurred over a 2.5-year span from 2015 to 2017. BGP works based on implicit trust between providers, known as autonomous systems or ASs within the protocol. BGP hijackings are especially concerning because they allow spies from China, Russia, or elsewhere to monitor or tamper with any unencrypted data that improperly passes through their networks before reaching their intended destination. Since BGP favors shortest or most direct paths, erroneous or malicious announcements can easily reroute traffic. Securing BGP has been a topic of conversation in the IETF for years, but little progress has been made. Even if a more secure version of BGP was ratified, it could take years of retrofitting of backbone routers before it could be made useful. U.S. government officials have other concerns. Hacking groups widely believed to work on behalf of the Chinese government have been in active attacks against the U.S. and its allies. One group that's known under a variety of names, including LEED, Barium, Wicked Panda, Graph, PassTV, Axiom, and Winty, is behind a decade of malicious attacks, according to a report released in 2018. The Chinese government has also been tied to attacks on satellite, defense, and telecom firms, the FDIC, and Google, to name only a few. China Telecom Americas has vehemently denied allegations in the recommendation jointly issued by Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, Defense, State Commerce, and the United States Trade Representative. Complicating matters, attributing these attacks to specific groups or countries is notoriously difficult, since attackers frequently plant false flags that wrongly implicate rivals. What's more, BGP routing mishaps happen repeatedly and frequently as a part or result of error and not malice. And in cases where BGP events are the work of China or other countries, kicking their telecoms out of the U.S. does little to stop hijackings. BGP hijacks, according to one expert, can be conducted from anywhere and don't require physical presence in the U.S., which makes this move seem even more like punishment or retribution than a move that would actually stop hijacks.
When school is online, the digital divide grows greater. In an article last week, Wired Magazine discusses how the closing of schools and the abrupt shift to, hey, everyone's a homeschooler now, reality, has underscored what Twiat listeners will be familiar with as Mo's rant about broadband equity. The article describes a Washington State Community College student who lives 7 miles outside of a town with neither cable nor a DSL line available, and instead relies on a cellular wireless hotspot with throughput that can sometimes allow her to watch a video, but often doesn't support even reloading a page. This is a story mirrored across the country and has left millions struggling to find a way to finish this school term. The FCC says that more than 650 providers have signed its Keep America Connected pledge to not terminate internet service over pandemic-related financial troubles, to waive late fees, and to allow free access to Wi-Fi services. But these offerings are available only in locations where those companies already provide service. Last year, Microsoft estimated 162 million people in the U.S., that's half the population, don't use broadband internet because it's unavailable or unaffordable. As in previous times of adversity, humans have dug in and gotten creative to help solve this problem. Schools and libraries are installing outdoor access points to move the Wi-Fi to parking lots and create drive-in homework sessions. Schools are distributing Chromebooks and tablets for students who need devices suitable for online learning. Teachers are recording lectures, and districts are shipping them on DVD and thumb drives. I've been working with schools that are equipping school buses with Wi-Fi access points that use a cellular connection for a backhaul, so they can leave buses equipped with solar panels in parking lots and parks to create mobile drive-in hotspots. Others are reconfiguring buses to create homework cubicles that can be disinfected in between use. Communities and schools are having to apply creativity to low and high-tech solutions because the FCC has spent the last few years impeding efforts to close the digital divide. The Rural Digital Opportunity Fund, which replaced a previous initiative called the Connect America Fund, is, well, underfunded. The FCC voted to auction off wireless spectrum that had been reserved for schools to the highest bidder. And one of Ajit Pai's first moves as FCC chair was to scale back a plan to allow subsidized telecommunication services to include internet access. More problematic is that we don't know just how many people, and especially students, do not have access to high-speed internet because the FCC relies on self-reported data from broadband providers. They consider that an entire census block has service if a single broadband provider claims to offer service anywhere within the service block, even if most homes within the area can't get service. And yes, Frontier, I'm looking at you. This means that the 21 million people the FCC estimates has no access to broadband internet, 6% of the U.S. population, is at best an underrepresentation of the scope of the problem.
Now, lots of mobile telecom companies are in the news because of their offerings to people during the current global crisis. Well, it seems TracFone might not be one of them. Now, for decades, big and small telecoms alike have abused the FCC Lifeline program, a fund that's supposed to help subsidize telecom connectivity for low-income users. Now, even though the program has helped many low-income Americans, it also has been routinely smeared in fraud and scandal due to unethical telecom giants, spotty enforcement, and a failure to adequately track how this money is spent. Now, this comes to light with the FCC announcement that it actually will be fining low-cost mobile service provider TracFone a cool $6 million for making up fictitious subscribers in order to nab Lifeline money it wasn't owed. Now, some of the fraud has almost comical in its depth and scope that it should have fairly easy to spot earlier. Now, late last year, the Wall Street Journal also issued a report showing Sprint had allegedly been engaging in this kind of fraud for the better part of the last decade. AT&T also spent years ripping off the program before receiving a wrist slap for the behavior. Like most U.S. regulator enforcement actions, the fines usually wind up being a tiny infraction of the money that was gleaned from ripping off the taxpayers, users, or even competitors from the better part of the several decades. Now, this move by the FCC is to try to reconcile some of this by going after deeper infractions and deeper pockets. So let's hope by following through with this big monetary fine, they will also help other telecoms, big or small, rethink the way they follow the program. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to the bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And that's LastPass. Now, as you are preparing your remote workforce, it's important to keep security on top of mind with aiding employee productivity. Now, transitioning to full work from home environment can actually be really complicated. Now, LastPass is here to make that transition easier without decreasing your security. Now, think about all the things you have to think about here. Number one, obviously, is security. Now, with an uptick in coronavirus-related phishing attacks, LastPass reduces the risk of phishing schemes by never autofilling passwords on suspicious websites. That's right. You never really thought about that, right? They actually can do that. Now, for remote employees accessing your corporate VPN, LastPass adds an additional layer of security directly to your VPN through biometric multi-factor authentication. That brings really good peace of mind there. Now, another thing you should be thinking about is obviously access as well. That's right. Regardless of where or how your employees need access, LastPass ensures your employees have secure access to their work applications with SSO and password management. Plus, LastPass offers offline mode for those who lose their connection but still need password management and multi-factor authentication so your employees can gain access no matter where they are what kind of activity they have. Now, sharing is also an important focus area. Now, seamless collaboration with coworkers is essential when working remotely. In fact, LastPass enables remote employees to securely share passwords across teams in order to stay on top of critical projects. And in fact, all of this is not really going to be great unless it's really simple to do. Now, intuitive admin and end user experiences allow you to get up and running in minutes, not days. That's right. LastPass can really get you going. LastPass has a globally dispersed, ready-to-respond support and success team to actually aid with an efficient LastPass deployment. And in fact, if you want really great control, LastPass enables IT teams to remain in complete control over which employees are accessing which resources, no matter where they're working, for unified visibility over access and authentication. People have their favorite tool, and mine is definitely LastPass. It saves me time. It saves me money. In fact, I love LastPass so much. I've been using it so often, I don't even remember I'm using it anymore. In fact, it's one of my favorite tools. Think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to. Every site, that's even the most secure and personal sites that you have, your financial sites, your business sites, even your social networks and email sites, you name it. LastPass is the way to go to ensure you're secure going forward. Increased security doesn't have to be complex. Start your journey today by visiting lastpass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. That's lastpass.com/twit. And we thank LastPass for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. And, you know, there's lots of tracking applications out there, and they tend to cause a lot of the privacy alarm from going off. And I actually can hear the ringing in my ears when I think about tracking applications. But this application that's been come to light here could actually be legit. Let me get your thoughts on this. Now, Apple and Google are developing a smartphone platform that tries to track the spread of the novel coronavirus at scale and at the same time preserve the privacy of iOS and Android users who opt into the program. Now, the cross-platform system will use the proximity capabilities built into Bluetooth low energy transmissions to track the physical contacts of participating phone users. Now, if a user later tests positive for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, he or she can then go choose to enter the result in a health department approved app. Now, the app will then contact all the participating phone users who have recently come within 6 or so feet of the person. Now, this sounds very dangerous and it sounds very worrisome, right, from privacy perspective. Let's hear. You're probably wondering what kind of technology is here that ensures the privacy of users. Well, this is the system. It applies a technology approach known as contact tracing, or the practice of figuring out everyone an infected individual has recently been coming in contact with. Now, a recent published study by a group at Oxford suggested that the coronavirus is too infectious for contact tracing to work well using traditional methods. But the researchers did propose using smartphones, since they're nearly ubiquitous and they don't rely on faulty memories of people who have been infected, and they can track a nearly unlimited number of contacts of participating users. Now, the first instinct is correct, because mobile-based contact tracing may be more effective, but it also poses a serious threat to individual privacy, since it opens the door to central databases that track the movements and social interactions of potentially millions, potentially even billions of people. Now, the platform Apple and Google are developing uses an innovative cryptographic scheme that aims to allow the contact tracing to work at scale without posing the risk of privacy to those who opt into the system. Now, still skeptical? All right, well, listen to what the system does and how it does it. Unlike traditional contact tracing, the phone platform doesn't collect names or locations or identifiable information. Instead, when two or more users opt in the system, they actually come in physical contact. Their phones use BLE to swap anonymous identifier beacons, kind of like a token swapping. Now, the identifiers, which in technical jargon are known as rolling proximity identifiers, or basically just an identifier for that user, and not a unique identifier, but not a personal identifier. Now, that change roughly every 15 minutes to prevent wireless tracking of a device. And as the users move about and come into proximity with other users, their phones continue to exchange these anonymous identifiers. Now, periodically, the user devices will also download broadcast beacon identifiers of anyone who is tested positive for the COVID-19. Now, in the event someone reports to the system that they've tested positive, their phone will contact a central server, upload 14 days of their identifiers. Now, non-infective users download the daily tracing keys, and because of the way each rolling proximity identifier is generated, End users' phones can recreate the index by time and just the daily tracing key for each day. And when they know about that, when they actually get this data, they can show an alert whether they've actually come in contact with someone who has actually been infected. This is a very interesting system. It sounds great on paper, but I do want to throw the first question. I'll throw it out to you first, Bam. You work in the security space. Is this just another way for Big Brother or Sister to look into the controlling the information, or is it a kind of system that we just need now?
Well, I think it's a fine line, right? So data has been the key missing ingredient in all the decisions we've been making here, especially in North America, with regards to quarantine decisions, for example, that are really hurting the economy right now. And when you hear our leaders say that they want to restart the economy, they know that they can't do it unless they have good information that indicates that the spread has slowed or that it's peaked and on the decline. Right now, much of the data that we're looking at is really not so much an indication of how fast the disease is spreading. It's how fast we're able to ramp up testing. So we really have kind of bad data right now. And so this is what we need if we want to make better decisions and get back to business as usual as quickly as possible. However, needs a lot of third-party vetting, in my view, for us to really be able to implement such a system without ending up like one of the states in Southeast Asia where privacy isn't concerned. They track everything anyway. So they were able to squash the spread with sort of built-in Big Brother controls. So it's a very, very fine line. But in the state that we're in, I think people might welcome a bitter pill if it's the medicine that'll get the economy and get life back to normal.
Yeah, that's true. I think obviously security and privacy is on top of people's minds. It's a huge concern here. And obviously it sounds like they're kind of just exchanging these unidentifiable tokens and hope that they can then kind of detect whether somebody has come in contact with one of those tokens or not. Do you think that it's enough here for security and privacy to just use these tokens and not have to worry about anything else?
Well, I think it would be if we had a third party vetting that said, the implementation here is truly anonymous, right? So we've seen before studies that have shown, quote unquote anonymous pings off cell phone towers that are tracked, and that location data being shared is very easily de-anonymized by looking at where they go home to every night and where they go to work to. And it becomes very, very easy to start tracking an individual if you know their home address. And home addresses are pretty easy to come by. So I think there is a fine line here, and there has to be, somebody like the ACLU, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, would be well positioned, in my view, to look at what Google and Apple are up to and say whether or not it's truly anonymous.
Well, I want to throw this to you next because, this sounds like a very interesting system. It sounds like it could potentially work. I want to get your thoughts. Will this even work? Because doesn't everyone in the world have to be using it? It's kind of like a race condition in software. If you're not using it at the time that you run into somebody, then they won't be able to tell you whether you've been infected or not or detected or not. So will this system even work?
That's a really good question. First, I want to say that I'm 100% with what Bam had to say, that we need to have I know the ACLU has already spoken up and sort of in favor of this, but EFF would certainly I would want to hear them weigh in on this. A hacker's going to hack, right? So as soon as somebody tells me this is 100% secure or safe or anonymous, my BS radar goes way up on that one. Maybe I'm just cynical or paranoid at this point. But then again, back to your question, and with the number of people who we know are completely asymptomatic, and are still ending up testing positive, I don't know, unless you get a much higher percentage of the people being tested and a very high percentage of people opting in for this, And again, this is going to work better in places where you have a high population density, in urban settings. But in the more rural areas where, ironically, we're also not testing, there's no testing, for example, in my entire county going on. Then you have cell phone coverage problems, and maybe most people living off of a Cricket pay as you go cell plan, you're not going to have as good results. I would be more interested in the back end of how you deal, because Bam's right, we have bad data, but it just as problematic of having bad data or not enough data. Is if you have too much data, how can you scale this so that it's actually can keep track? Because as we've seen, we haven't used this term in this on this session yet, but the R naught value, or how contagious this is, it looks like it's actually fairly high. So you could end up with a logarithmic expansion of the data that you're trying to track.
Right. Well, I do want to stay on the cynic side here for just a second, and I want to get one last comment from you. What do you think? Can this system maybe spread some more fear than do good? Because imagine receiving a random notification just by jumping onto the system like for a week or so that you potentially could be infected. I think that would almost strike sheer fear, sheer struggle within me, emotional struggle, I think, if I saw that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I can't think of a a drama series or hasn't used that same MacGuffin in some of their storylines. So it's basically the red shirt of Star Trek.
Right. All right. Well, let's jump onto the next bite, because I think this one's a little bit more focused on security. And in fact, there's working from home has been mandated, obviously, because of COVID-19, but it's obviously had been potentially elevating security risks and cyber risks for enterprise organizations as well. Now, in fact, BitSight, a leader in security ratings, has reported that nearly one in two organizations has one or more devices accessing its corporate network from home with at least one malware infection. That's right. In fact, BitSight has attempted to quantify some of those risks in a new study based on data for a sample of 41,000 U.S. organizations. Now, the security vendor examined residential IP addresses that were associated with corporate networks to see if they could identify attributes that pose unique cyber risks to corporations. Now, as part of its research, BitSight compared the overall health of devices attached to work from home remote offices, IPs with those devices, and the typical office networks. Now, the research showed that home networks were 3.5 times more likely than corporate networks to have at least one malware family, and 7.5 times more likely to have 5 or more distinct types of malware. Now, BitSight found some malicious software such as Mirai, which has been used to launch a massive distributed denial of service attacks back in 2016, 20 times more frequently on home networks than on enterprise networks. Now, BitSight study also found that 25% of devices on home networks, such as PCs, network attached printers, smart home products, had one or more services exposed on the internet. Nearly one in two organizations, or 45% roughly, had one or more devices accessing its corporate network from home network with at least that malware infection. Now, Bam, I wanted to throw this to you first, because obviously you focus a lot on security. Can you give us more context here? What are you seeing for organizations? Obviously, you see an influx of people working from home. Are you seeing a change in the way the organizations are handling this?
So, in many cases, we're seeing a loosening of standards, right, to make things more accessible and more ready to go. We're also seeing massive expansions of capacity for organizations that can afford it. But often when you ramp up something quickly, some things can get missed. And those are things like, making sure everybody has access to multi-factor authentication. It could be the fact that some folks are not used to working from home and are have a desktop. They're not equipped with laptops, which means loosening standards to enable those home PCs or home laptops to attach to the remote access points. So that's a huge change in the corporate security standards that they're used to being able to enforce, because
what are the, you know, they don't have the wherewithal necessarily to ship out, you know, dozens or hundreds of laptops to accommodate these suddenly remote workers. So they have a, you know, a very difficult choice to make in terms of providing access, you know, broadly to newly remote workers. The other thing is that because attackers are going to attack, as Mo mentioned in the previous bite, as soon as we know that remote access is this big thing, these are always getting attacked. Now it's ramping up. Right now they know that there's you know, they might be attackers know there might be a loosening of standards to enable more people to gain access. So now they're going to attack our remote access points with more ferocity, with more ingenuity, and then you have a suddenly certainly a different threat model than you had 30 or 60 days ago.
Right. I think the interesting thing is, you know, what we talked about this in last episodes of TWiET. I mean, one of the big things, obviously, especially as a home user or as a home remote worker, you know, obviously keeping your devices up to date is one of the big important things here that we need to make sure you're doing. And obviously also ensuring that you're keeping an eye out of, you know, maybe isolating your home devices, your IoT devices, your Alexas and that kind of thing on a separate network, if you know how to do that. But Heather, I want to throw this to you too. Similar question I gave to Bam, because I think you have a lot of experience with working with different types of organizations. Are you seeing organizations shift on how they're handling things here, especially with the increased amount of remote workers?
Yeah, and it's actually interesting because I was thinking about this earlier. If you're as old as I am, you can remember that IT departments used to go on seek and destroy missions to hunt down access points because Wi-Fi was not secure and it was not going to be something that we were going to be offering, you know, or allowing in the workplace. And, you know, shift 10 years, 15 years on, the IT, there were a lot of IT departments that had the same attitude about work from home. This was not something that they wanted to support. It wasn't that anything that they were scaling up to support. And so all of a sudden, the difference now is that we've had basically a Mother Nature saying, hold my beer. you're going to figure this out, right? So I know that companies are struggling to deal with the scaling of it. Bam was talking about how, you know, when you, in order to roll something out fast, there's going to be things that are going to get missed. I think maybe overnight, Padre with one Twitter tweet doubled the amount of Fold at Home users with his encouragement. And I immediately started seeing messages from IT departments saying, you know, Fold at Home is not supported. You're killing our VPN. Those kinds of things, you know, we all want to help where, however we can. I think that I know this has been an overused phrase recently, but our new reality. I think that when I first started working from home in 2004, I worked for a company who literally made the technology that enabled people to work from home. And there was a huge mindset at the top level, the e-staff level, that unless you were in the office and we could see you, you weren't actually working. And this was a big thing to overcome. I think that this is going to be one of those things where we have to evolve very quickly and solve the problems on the other end. And I also agree 100% with Bam is that we have increased our attack vector enormously with that. And I just would like to remind you guys that of all of us, Bam probably has the most secure home network because he lives, eats, and breathes that. I know I have bad habits, even though I know better. The average person who's coming home to do their average office work at home is going to look at that home router and wonder if it's even possible. Not only what is a VPN, but can you even VPN separately off, you know, all of the devices that are all of a sudden now have access are an attack vector into a corporate network. How many thousands of IoT devices with Mirai possibly on them now have basically a side channel attack vector into a corporate network.
Right. Yeah.
Just
I think
to
it makes
terrify
sense.
You enough.
Yeah. I mean, I can honestly say, I'm not always as careful as I maybe should be. I think one of the big things is a lot of organizations nowadays are starting to lock down data and data access to the point where you can't even access it unless you're over VPN. I'm starting to see that in the wild. And even then, they want you using devices that have been registered, and they know that you're not using them for personal use and that kind of thing. So I think that these types of steps are going to be need to be done by organizations in the current climate, especially when people are, you know, shifting between their, you know, their normal devices at home, their, you know, play devices versus their work devices. And sometimes that line gets blurred. And these types of things need to be taken covered. So we'll see what happens. We'll definitely see how it evolves over time. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. And this is now my favorite part of the show because we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have a really great guest, Chris Gwynn, CEO of LogDNA. And he's going to take us through what's going on in modern and modernizing log management. Really excited for him to be here. Chris, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. This is super exciting to have, especially during these times in this climate.
Yeah. Now, I'm really excited to have guests on that I really revere their work, their company. LogDNA is like one of my favorite companies because they have some really great features. They're really focused on developers and DevOps. Yeah. Now, before we get into all of that, though, our audience loves to hear origin stories and people's kind of journey through tech. Can you maybe take us through a quick journey through tech and how you ended up at LogDNA?
Absolutely. So this is actually my third co-founder opportunity with the same co-founders. So we started three companies. We met in class for freshman year of college in computer science and .NET class. And as our journey progressed, we built and sold our first company, second company. We learned a lot. And the third one, we got an opportunity to move to California and to participate in this Accelerator Y Combinator. And we had an original idea, but only to realize we built this internal logging system that was way more powerful than what we originally thought. So we decided to spin it out. And a lot of the functionality that we wish we had as developers is, you know, ease of use, super fast search speed, but also like Kubernetes. We're big on Kubernetes, and we saw a lot of gaps in that area. And that was the origin of LogDNA. 4 years later, we work with thousands of customers or team size of almost 100, and it's been an amazing journey. But the best part is we're literally just getting started on where we could take this observability space.
So this kind of hits close home for me because LogDNA focuses on developers and what they need to be mm-hmm. kind of successful and scale at their work. Can you maybe take us through the essence of LogDNA?
Absolutely. So we empower developers. We empower them to be able to aggregate all their logs, be able to monitor it, be able to get a learn from it, be able to debug off of it. And in essence, it's to be able to tell developers what happened in the past, what's happening right now, but what's about to happen, and alert you accordingly. So it's kind of like mission controls to analyze your servers and application. It's nice that you come from the engineering background, so you understand, like, you need, this is mission critical as for software and applications. But I love the product that we're building today.
Yeah, I mean, especially in the current climate, you know, you have this increased cloud activity. You know, organizations are always looking for ways to ensure visibility into the health of their systems and their services. But it's challenging because there's not always a one solution fits all. A lot of times they try to figure out things in testing and, you know, that kind of thing. But once it gets to production, you know, everything is all hands on deck here, I think you could say. You know, maybe can you take us through some of the challenges you're seeing some of the organizations are doing and what organizations are doing without such a solution as LogDNA today for in production?
Oh, absolutely. The three challenges which creates opportunities for us is challenge number one, there's a vast amount of data that's happening with time, and it's only going to get busier. Challenge number two, with the evolution of DevOps and containers and microservices and Kubernetes, this data is super, super fragmented, right? So to be able to pull that information to one environment creates a huge challenge in a meaningful way that you could interact with this information. And the third challenge is one size doesn't fit all anymore. So gone were the days where people, you know, thought everything is going to happen in the public cloud, but environments are executed in private cloud, public cloud, on-prem. It's in a multi-cloud format. So you have to be able to anticipate these trends and this growth. And we have that platform that can handle the scale. Doesn't matter which environment's from, doesn't matter the source of the data, but also can be deployed in a multi-cloud format. So it's pretty nice to anticipate that curve and see it's only going to get busier with time with digital transformation.
Right, right, right. I do want to get into the scale comment you made, because the technology you guys are using is great. But I mean, one thing I'm seeing is lots of organizations are still working on that waterfall model. They're testing in environments, UAT environments. Mm-hmm. They're using system health monitoring to kind of ensure the mm-hmm. quality is good for their shipping product. What is log management technology doing for organizations that these other rings couldn't do?
I think it was very siloed in the past, whereas now you can take that information and anyone can access this data, whether it's, you know, your engineers, your DevOps, your infra team, or even business use cases, that they could tap into this information. I think when we talk about scale earlier, it's like be able to handle ingest, but also store and search this vast amount of data to make it relevant, right? You don't want to wait days to determine what happened. It's like you want this in real time as fast as you can.
Right, right, right. Well, we talk about volume of data, because obviously there's tons. And the more people work from home, the more people use the services, mm-hmm. the more data you're going to be getting, the more you have to kind of ingest at scale, process it, index it, produce, and basically produce insights and analytics on it. What kind mm-hmm. of technology are you using to handle that kind of thing?
So we actually, you know, at first when we started off, we had Logstash. We gave it a shot. We evolved to Kafka. And as we started handling our own scale and our own challenges, we built our own ingest bus that we internally, we call it Buzzsaw. And it wasn't a technology looking for a problem. It was like, ooh, guys, we have a problem at high scale. And it's nice that we're able to handle that from a ingest perspective, so that you could see real time of your logs, the live tail. And on the back end, you know, we're off of Elastic at the moment, and we found ways to optimize that search speed so that time is of the essence. When you're dealing with terabytes and terabytes a day, some of our customers are doing 50 terabytes a day. And it's one thing to search 50 terabytes, but it's another thing to search it at a window of 14 days. So time is of the essence. It's like, how do I find this needle in the haystack quick? And how do I debug this problem before it escalates as well?
Right. Makes sense. Now, before we get into some of the things you guys offer, because there's some really great tools, there's an amazing user interface I've interacted with before. I do want to get into the competitive talk really quick. Now, you're hitting just after your four-year mark, right? And obviously, mm-hmm. companies like Splunk have been doing this for around 15 years. What is LogDNA doing here that's the differentiator?
I think for us is that focus on developers. We want the ability that you're up and running in 10 minutes, right? Enterprise legacy companies think of a holistic, you know, rip and replace approach for the entire enterprise. Whereas we think that, you know, there's that department or that one BU business unit that says, I want to be up and running quick. I want to see visibility. Does it take, you know, 10 minutes to get up? So we're seeing more of in our journey to get developer love, get their adoption, and slowly land expanding over time, which is a nice position to be in. So we have the developer love from the bottom end, but also we have the enterprise confidence at the top. And, you know, IBM Watson uses LogDNA to analyze their logs. So it's nice to have that validation, and it's nice to have that product that can be used for different use cases at different scale.
Right. So you talk about getting started quickly, and obviously a lot of the organizations, they have tons and tons of data. What's kind of the, let's say you have, Padre, the previous host used to give this scenario of, let's say you have 10,000 seats, you have lots of users, and you have lots of data coming in. What's the first steps that they do to kind of get started with LogDNA?
First step is ingestion source. How are we going to take in the information? The second step that we think about is, so the ingestion source could be syslog, it could be code library, Kubernetes, and we try to make that easy. Not only do we want to make the ingestion process easy, but also the migration. I love the fact that in this space, they're accustomed to a solution, and our goal is to ensure that the migration period to even train engineers and developers is pretty easy. So our natural language processing, you don't have to learn a custom language. So we actually made it pretty intuitive. If you know how to use a search engine and how you search there, you definitely know how to use LogDNA. And most importantly, what do you want to be alerted on? What's the real value? And every different team, every different department has different use cases of what they want to see, what they want to be alerted on, and what matters in their world that's most important. So we are, I think, simplistic doesn't have to mean easy. It means it's also simplistic and powerful at the same time. So that's our core focus, how we think about this. And our use case is developers and infrastructure to debug and monitor. So that's our beachhead at the beginning, and then slowly we expand with time.
Right. So let's say your organization, you just hook up the connector, you start, ingesting data into the system. What's next? Mm-hmm. Do they go to a dashboard? Do they start seeing, generating insights? What happens next?
Great question. So they go to a dashboard and they start seeing logs in real time that's coming through. And the next question is, let's start setting up alerts, right? So what do you want to be notified on? What do you want to monitor? So you can definitely set alerts up that could get sent to email or Slack or PagerDuty or any notification system. But also there's dashboards that you want. So you actually want that dashboard. That doesn't mean things are going wrong. You just want to take that pulse check of the system. So you have the ability to visualize the data as well. With our platform.
So when you say you can set up alerts, is this like SMSs or this like emails? What kind of alerts can you set up? And are they just kind of simple alerts based off of, simple heuristics, or can you add scripting and stuff into that as well?
You can add scripting. As of now, the biggest use case is just like how many errors, a threshold, and let me get alerted from those thresholds, and we could send those alerts to any environment that you want to receive it. So it all depends. So we get alerts on like if I see 400 errors that happen in the span of 10 minutes, let me get alerted off that. Whereas I could see log volume, if log volume goes up for server logs, maybe something's wrong. So you have a lot of flexibility with our platform to be able to get alerted of how you want to get alerted.
That's cool. That's great. So I think, one of the important things that I see a lot is being able to ingest data from all different sources. You kind of alluded to a couple there. What kind of sources can you get data from? Like what kind of infrastructure and other sources can you use data from?
The best part is everything. Everything you think of. So like I say that as a little bit, because we have a custom webhook and we have code libraries and we have syslog. So literally like it's all ends of the spectrum. You know how to send it to us, we can ingest it. And that's the best part of having this flexible environment to be able to ingest that. And that was super, super important to us. It can't just be one size and one avenue. It's all across the board from a past system like a Heroku or from your Linux or your Kubernetes or your Ruby. We have it all.
That's great. So let me give you one scenario. I'm sure you're probably going to say, oh, we can do that anyways, but I wanted to kind of throw it out there anyways. I used to work in a brewery back in the day as a systems control engineer, and we used to program PLCs to obviously do counting and move the lines and detect a lot of errors in the system. And then logs would then come out of those things, and then we would have to ingest them somewhere and write special logic to create alerts and so on. Now, if I created my own, let's say IoT devices, and code's on there and all my code's on there and I produce logs from there, would LogDNA be able to ingest those as well and produce the same insights?
Absolutely. So it's funny you mentioned that. Two of the top three scooter companies use us specifically for the IoT use case. So we have a lot of this use case of like, hey, from the IoT devices, they send it up to us and they're monitoring it on a constant basis, down to like POS systems that have weak signals in terms of Wi-Fi, but they need to be able to aggregate and store these logs somewhere and be able to alert and monitor it closely. So we definitely have that use case. So the answer is definitely yes.
Fantastic. Cool. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because obviously they have a bunch of questions for you. I think I'll throw it over to Mo first. Mo?
Yeah, DevOps background that Lou has. But my question comes from, I spent this week, I was really excited to see that you were coming on here. I know how to pronounce Kubernetes thanks to Ian Coldwater. but I was looking at the case studies that you guys have. You have several case studies with IBM and some really good details on exactly differentiating, like exactly what containerization is. So I finally think I got a handle on it. My question is about, you were talking in one of the case studies, you're talking about cluster level logging. And I was wondering if you could go more into what that is.
Yep.
And I apologize if that's a noob question.
Cluster level logging, I don't know the full details of it. Cluster level logging is to be able to extract this information from different, we call it multi-cloud, so different environments. So it doesn't matter where it sits, where the data is stored. And as we think about our product, we have that option from a data residency perspective to be able to execute this in a multi-cloud format. Did I answer your question?
It answered it for me. Thank you.
Okay, perfect.
So thanks for logs are one of my favorite things. And you might have heard Lou flatter me by calling me a security expert, which is only halfway true. I know things about security, but I love logs because that's you know, if you've ever been in a SOC or NOC, you know, log analysis is sort of that's life. Whether you're in incident response or you're even if you're just in the NOC and you're just trying to troubleshoot an outage. So I come from obviously very infrastructure oriented background, and that's the one thing I didn't hear you really mention is like, are you ingesting from firewalls and IPSs and things like that, and what kind of facility does LogDNA have to, like, you know, surface insights about, you know, security incidents that are getting logged there? I'm sure you can ingest them based on the flexibility you're talking about. So I'm wondering, you know, how many of your customers are using it that way, sort of, you know, as an alternative or a new alternative to SIEM.
Great question. So we have the ability to ingest it. We're not the biggest, best use case for SIEM. And there's great SIEM products that are out there. So we actually complement them well versus trying to compete in that industry. I think over time, what you're going to start seeing is companies who are handling all the logs across the spectrum. How do we create value, whether it's from a logging perspective, metrics perspective, logging, APM, and SIEM? That question does come up often for us in terms of our product roadmap. And we do believe at one point in time, we'll think about that SIEM strategy because we can store it and we can derive additional data and value from that as well.
I that's what I'm sort of sensing. And I think one of the big things with forensic analysis that's going to become important is, you know, tracking where code gets introduced. You know, you talked about DevOps and CI/CD pipelines. And one of the mm-hmm. things that we see increasingly is like security tools being ingested into the CI/CD pipeline. So, you know, do you see, you know, when you talk about a complement to a SIEM, do you see any of your customers kind of trying to correlate sort of those DevOps activities with their what's going on in their SIEM? Because that's something that I think is potentially really exciting.
Yeah, I'm seeing a lot of customers use different solutions, and they're asking, like, at what point in time in life does this become one solution? And as of now, we're seeing best in breed, so they're correlating in different environments. And I truly believe at one point in time, we will have that single pane window so that you can have that one-stop shop. And for us, being 4 years old, we want to nail logging. Importantly, to nail, like, scale and ingest all the information. And, like, I think phase two in our journey is, okay, what do we want to do with the next? So we definitely think about our roadmap of adding that value over time from a developer's experience, whether you're a startup or up to an enterprise level as well. And the beauty for our platform when we think about logging is that we knew naturally compliance is a big element. So one of our fortes is we're fully compliant since the get-go. So PCI, SOC 2, GDPR, and we want to build that strong, strong foundation of logging. And then we think about the product development and product features after.
So would step three or your teenage years, would you be looking into disaster recovery?
Disaster recovery, not yet. I think our natural evolution is thinking about metrics. Our natural evolution is thinking about the APM aspect. And then slowly as we evolve and I guess out of teenage years and in the college years, it's more the SIEM product and what value could we add to our product.
Okay, so maybe the middle-aged years.
Middle-aged years, yes, absolutely.
And
anything's possible,
That's right. Everything's possible. I do want to go into one thing that I think maybe Heather had mentioned is a lot of the work that you're doing with IBM. Can you maybe go into some of the details around the partnership you have with IBM?
Absolutely. IBM had an open source solution to their customers. And as they started seeing the future of enterprise, they also noticed the value of Kubernetes. And we got approached by IBM to say, hey, what's the possibility of powering our logging system at scale? Right. So they say at scale is global. And I think at these moments in time as a startup, you don't get those opportunities many times, but it came with a lot of confidence and conviction that our technology could be able to provide that insights. So for them as IBM customers, they interact on their console. It's, you know, they don't have to change their environment, but one simple click, they can start ingesting logs and visualize the data of the live tail, send alerts, have the graphs, have all all the histograms. And it is a rare opportunity to be able to have that with IBM, but it comes with a lot of conviction that scales there, compliance there, multi-cloud is a big element, but also Kubernetes was one of the big fortes that we work closely with our teams on. And simple two kube command lines are up and running, and we're pretty bullish, and we believe that Kubernetes is here to stay, and it's gonna grow with time with enterprise companies, and we love it. We're pretty excited about that opportunity with IBM. So it's such great confidence and validation.
Now you did mention one thing. You talked about that you were SOX 2 compliant. Are you seeing a lot of shift in the way that that LogDNA does things based off of GDPR and SOX compliance and all the other compliances, mm-hmm. or is it mm-hmm. just kind of built into to kind of the architecture you have?
It's built into the architect for now. So it's not like we were pursuing, HIPAA compliant companies off the bat. We just want to have that peace of mind to say, if you're looking for certain compliance, we can definitely cover you across certain bases. So as we grow and as we build up our go-to-market team, we'll start isolating certain use cases that we penetrate heavily, whether it's in fintech for PCI or healthcare with HIPAA. And it was a unique blessing in disguise. We came from a different company that we had to be Sarbanes-Oxley compliant. So everything we did moving forward was with security in mind to get fully audited. So it's nice to have that. But at the moment, we don't pursue it heavily.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time. I do want to kind of give you a chance to tell the folks at home where their organizations to go to learn more about LogDNA, maybe even get started. Yeah.
Absolutely. If you got simple, come visit us at logdna.com. You quick setup, you're probably up and running in less than 5 minutes, and our team's happy to help out if you have any logging questions.
Fantastic. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've sat through another hour of the Best Dang Enterprise podcast in the universe, and you should stop resisting the urge to play us during your virtual social hours at work. But I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-hosts, starting with our very own Mr. Brian McHenry, Global Solutions Architect over at F5 Networks. Bam, what's going on with you in the coming weeks, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, I'll tell you where to find my team's great work and the extended F5 solutions engineering team. It'll be at F5's Agility Conference. It's gone virtual, just like everything else. So if you were jonesing back in March to come to Agility and get your hands on some labs and see some breakout sessions and hear what we've got going on in the future, head on over to f5.com/agility. You can register for free, get hands-on live virtual instructors who will take you through labs and teach you all the new cool stuff we're doing with Nginx, with Shape Security, and even some really innovative stuff on the F5 Big IP platform. So, nothing going on with me personally, but I encourage everybody to head on over to f5.com/agility. Register for some virtual lab sessions, some virtual breakout sessions, and all totally for free and there for you. Keep you busy, keep you well informed while you're riding this quarantine out at home.
Thanks, Ben, for being here. Well, folks, we have to thank Mrs. Heather Williams, Manager of Solution Engineering at Ruckus Networks. Heather, what's going on with you for the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, I think you can find me over at f5.com/agility. That sounds like fun. So I am at Mo Better Wi-Fi on Twitter. That's mostly my snark and just a little bit of professional notices. I have been working. I know that I've talked to you guys about the work that I do with ITDRC, the IT Disaster Resource Center, and we have been ramping up at ITDRC since the beginning of the year. We've been keeping an eye on not just the COVID-19 evolution, but of course, there's no such thing in Mother Nature as a natural disaster season. So we have to deal with those things as well. We go in after a natural disaster and set up the comms for first responders and communities that have been affected, evacuees. And we are setting up homework hotspots and comms for hospital field units across the country. So I've been working with my company, CommScope, which has purchased Ruckus, and we have about $900,000 worth of switches and outdoor access points that are being shipped and will be rolling out just in another week or two.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much, Mo, for being here. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and listen to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to the show. So go out right now to our show page, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the guest information, the co-host information, plus all the links we do for the stories we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos, you'll have those really helpful and subscribe and download links. That's right. Support the show by getting your audio or video or HD video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or even on any one of your podcast applications as well. That's right. We're on all of them. It's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news. Now, after you've subscribed, you might as well impress your friends, your family, and your coworkers with the gift of Twyatt, because you know what? This information could be useful to them as well. Now, if you've already subscribed and you're available every week on Fridays at 1:30 p.m. Pacific, we do this show live. That's right. Live.twit.tv is where we post it. You can actually do it on there, or you can check us out on live on YouTube and other areas. In fact, if you're going to jump and watch the show live, you might as well jump into our chat room as well. We have some really great people in there. Chickenhead, Laquisius, Chumley, Zach Gowen, a bunch of other people are in there. They're interacting. They're giving us questions. They're directing the conversation. It's really great. So if you want to jump in the chat room, irc.twit.tv, you can jump in there and have a good chat and talk and interact with us, the host and the co-hosts. But if you cannot be live and you cannot jump in live, you don't have enough time during the day, obviously feel free to subscribe and listen, but then you can still be part of the conversation. That's right. We have another place to go, twit.community, HTTPS, twit.community. And there is a great website out there that the entire community is out there, the Twit Army, the Twit Riot. A lot of times the co-hosts are out there talking about the shows. It allows you to be part of the conversation 24/7, bunch of great discussions about technology and the current events and the current climate. Feel free to jump out there and be part of Twit and the conversation anytime, anywhere, 24/7, twit.community. Remember, you can always follow me, twitter.com/LouMM. I need some more followers. Come on, guys. Plus, I also really love to talk about Twit and Twyatt and as well as enterprise tech. There, I'll put all my enterprise tidbits. And of course, I love having conversations with people like you as well. Plus, you can always also see what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft. Of course, you could always go out to dev.office.com. There we post the latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience to be more productive for you and your organization. And look out soon for more of our office script capabilities to allow you to actually generate and record your Excel work and habits and be able to replay them back and be more productive. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we really appreciate their support. We couldn't do this show without them. Also, thank everyone at Twit, especially the engineers. They continue to do a great job, even in this crazy environment that we're working in and we're living in. And they continue to do it really seamlessly and bring us really great content. So thank you to all their support. Also, thank you to Mr. Brian Chiebert. He is not only our co-host and our friend, but he's also our tireless producer as well. And we couldn't do this show without him. He does all the bookings and the plannings for the show. And we really couldn't be as organized as we are without him. So thank you for all his support and all his work. But of course, before we sign out, I have to thank our editor, Victor, behind the scenes, of course, our TD for today, Jeff, our engineer. Thank you, Jeff, so much for the support. Of course, I used to always kind of ask a wacko question about the what's going on during the show. But I want to ask you, during this time of remote work and a lot of people doing video and audio, what kind of suggestions do you have to them to be a little bit more successful for like that remote work, the successful audio video type scenario?
Well, last week we talked about the importance of microphone choice, access one. We know everybody can't get a good microphone. Test it before you go live. It's always a good thing to test your stuff before you go live. You know, there's lots of cameras out there, so you want to make sure you have a good camera and set it to the best resolution. And always am doing is trying to find that darn cable. You always think you have enough cables, and then you never have the one you need at the time you need it. And it's amazing how many different cable combinations there are. So, yeah, lots to think about.
You're right. We definitely should have some kind of show this week in cables or something, because there's really tens of millions of types of cables. But maybe next time. And until next time, I'm Louis Moresco, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.